There's this company called Successories that sells motivational posters. You're probably familiar with their work. They're the folks that sell posters that look kind of like this. Rowing team there with the caption says teamwork. It says here, teamwork is the ability to work together toward a common vision, the ability to direct individual accomplishments towards organizational objectives. It's the fuel that allows common people to attain uncommon results. The idea is that an employer will go out and buy these posters, put them in a nice pretty frame, hang them in their lobby, hang them in their employee break room, you know, so that they can convey to their customers and convey to their employees some of their values and some of their vision for their business, that sort of thing. So here's another. It's a beautiful picture of a sunset with a quote from Helen Keller. It says, "Keep your face to the sun and you cannot see the shadows." They're pretty popular. I'd expect a lot of you, many of you have probably seen them maybe at your place of work, maybe at the school or at places of business that you frequent. One more, a mountainside with the quote that says, "Excellence. Some excel because they're destined to, most excel because they're determined to." That's inspiring, right? That makes you want to go out and sell some widgets, right? That's the idea. It makes you want to go out and grab life by the horns. But there's another business that looked all of the success that Successories was having, and they looked at it a little bit more cynically. This other business is called Despair.com. And they question whether or not motivation is really something that you can get from a poster. And so they came out with their own line of products, their own line of posters. They call them demotivators. Okay, their posters are called demotivators. Here's a few examples. First one, looks like that first one, you know, rowing team, whole deal, but read the caption. It says, "Get to work. You aren't being paid to believe in the power of your dreams." Or again, another pretty picture, looks like a Successories product, but the quote says, "Motivation. If a pretty poster and a cute saying are all it takes to motivate you, you probably have a very easy job. The kind robots will soon be doing." They've got a whole bunch of these. Again, the website's despair.com. You can spend a lot of time there. It's a hoot. Here's one of my favorites. The guy chasing the girl, it says, "Persistence. It's over, man. Let her go." I like that. Or this one. This is my favorite. "It takes 43 muscles to frown, 17 to smile, but it doesn't take any to just sit there with a dumb look on your face." I like that. And then there's this. I think what this is, this is a lava flow running over a highway. And it says, "Obstacles. Some things cannot be overcome with determination and a positive attitude." Now, here's my point. Here's why I'm showing you these. The demotivators get at this nagging truth. Sometimes, even when you do everything right, life does not work out in your favor. The Successories product line is built on the notion that if you have the right attitude and if you put in the right sort of effort, then life is always going to be successful for you. And some of the time, even most of the time, that's true, right? You work hard enough and you've got the right attitude, you put enough blood and sweat and tears into it, you're going to get a good result. That's why those Successories products are popular. That's why employers hang them in their places of work. Because if you try, you know, you're going to get good results most of the time. But not all of the time. Sometimes, no matter how hard you try, things go against you. Some obstacles simply can't be overcome with a positive attitude. Or, as this poster says, "The journey of 1,000 miles sometimes ends very, very badly." And that leads to this question. Is life fair? When we do everything right, and we give our best effort, and life still throws curveballs at us, sometimes we wonder, is life fair? I mean, you're making the sweetest lemonade you can, you know, you're making the best tasting lemonade, and life just keeps serving you more lemons. Is that fair? Is life fair? Is God fair? Which leads us to the book of Habakkuk. Last week I started a series called When Life Doesn't Make Sense, based on this little book of Habakkuk. It's found in the Old Testament in the middle of a section called the Minor Prophets. It's just a 3-chapter book, and basically it's a prayer journal. The prophet Habakkuk is writing down his thoughts, his complaints, towards God. He's sort of his thoughts towards God, and then God answers. And so you've got a complaint, and you get God's answer. You get a complaint, you get God's answer. And in essence, what's happening is Habakkuk is living at a time when the nation of Judah isn't doing very well. There's a corrupt king on the throne. There's a weak government where the religious system has fallen apart. So there's violence and people are cheating one another. There's social injustice and poverty. And Habakkuk basically calls God's attention to all of the badness in Judah. And he asks, in essence, how long, O Lord? How long are you going to let all of this bad continue? And God answers, and we looked at this last week. God answers, and he says, in essence, he says, I've got this, Habakkuk. I've got a plan. And here's my plan. I'm going to take the Babylonians, and I'm going to send them in. And the Babylonians are violent, and they're greedy, and they're immoral, and they don't believe in God. And they're going to come in, and they're going to clean house. That's the plan. And Habakkuk hears that, and he decides he's not so sure he likes God's plan. Right? To Habakkuk, that plan sounds a little extreme. Does God really need to use the very wicked Babylonians to punish the wicked Judeans? Right? Okay, you know, Habakkuk says, okay, I know we're bad, God, but they're a lot worse. So is that fair to take these very, very wicked Babylonians to punish the wicked Judeans? Is that fair? And so now we get to what the New International Version of the Bible calls Habakkuk's second complaint. And some scholars think that Habakkuk actually is writing this. This is sometime after he wrote his first complaint, that several years have passed, and now the Babylonians have actually invaded, and they're in the land. And now Habakkuk is journaling his thoughts to God again. And here's what he writes. It's Habakkuk chapter 1, starting at verse 12. And he says, O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. O Lord, you've appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Habakkuk starts with very good theology. He paints a very accurate depiction of God. Basically, he says God is eternal. God is from everlasting. That means there's no beginning to God. He's the uncreated one. Everything else is created, but not God. And he's the Holy One. That means he's set apart. That means he does no wrong. There's no evil in God. So basically Habakkuk says God is in an entirely different category from everything else in all of creation. I mean, he's not created. He's eternal. He's always been. You and I, we have beginnings. We're created. He's the Holy One. We're not. We're sinful. And so there's this distinction. God is in a category all by himself. And he does no wrong. Says his eyes are too pure to look on evil. That doesn't mean he never sees evil. God bears witness to evil every day. I mean, he's watching you. So every evil deed, every impure thought you've ever thought, God has borne witness. He sees that. But what this expression means is that his eyes are too pure, is that he never approves of evil. He never looks on evil and in a way that blesses it or calls it good. That he does not tolerate wrong. This is very good theology. This is a very accurate description of God. But it raises an inevitable question, which is the rest of verse 13. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Habakkuk's wondering, is this fair? How can the Holy God use a group of people as deplorable as the Babylonians to execute his judgment? It's as though Habakkuk is saying, okay, now look, I know at the beginning I was saying, God, it's bad. I was asking you to come and do something about it. But now that I've seen what you want to do about it, I'm not so sure that that's a good solution. The Babylonians are even worse. He's saying, I know that we're bad, the Jews are bad, but the Babylonians are even worse. I said last week, this is like using a dirty broom to clean house. This is a case of the cure being worse than the disease. In fact, to get at just how bad the Babylonians are, Habakkuk uses a sort of parable. Verses 14 through 17. It says, you've made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and he's glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? Okay, this is like a metaphor. And Habakkuk's saying the Babylonians are like fishermen. They're like those big factory fishing boats that are in the Atlantic right now. Have you heard about these things? That they pull mile-long trawling nets, and they just sort of go through the Atlantic and scoop up anything that gets in their way, and then they pull them onto their boat, and then they pull out the stuff that they want to sell, and anything else that ends up in their net, they just sort of discard it. It's ocean trash. And Habakkuk says, the Babylonians are like that. They're just sort of marching across the land, and anybody that gets in their way, they're destroying. They're taking what they want and discarding the rest. And they're like fishermen just sort of taking the fish and sorting through them. The last line there, how long is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I mean, that's bad. The Babylonians are bad. But here's the worst part in Habakkuk's mind. The worst part is they don't even know that it's God who's allowing them to do these things. Instead, they act like fishermen who think their nets are their gods. You see that in verse 16? It says, he sacrifices to his net and he burns incense to his dragnet. See, they think it's their own cleverness, their own strength, their own ingenuity, the Babylonians do, that allows them to conquer nations like this, like a fisherman who thinks, you know, his net is the one who's bringing in the fish. They don't even know God. These Babylonians don't know God. They don't know that it's Jehovah that stands behind all of their success. And now they're invading the promised land and tearing down the temple of Solomon, and they're carrying God's chosen people away into exile. And Habakkuk is wondering, how is that fair? How is that right? Now let me pause for a moment in the exposition of the text here to make a couple of observations about fairness. And we wonder how it can be fair when, you know, we put in all of this work and we do all of the right things and then life doesn't go the way we want it to. We especially wonder how it can be fair when we see somebody else who doesn't put in the effort, they're not trying, and life seems to be going swimmingly for them. We wonder, how is that fair? Habakkuk's wondering, how can it be these Babylonians are so wicked and they're so vile and they're so far from God, and yet they're the ones who are conquering Judah? How is that fair? Well, the first observation on fairness is this. Fairness does not come on a sliding scale. Right and wrong, righteous and unrighteous, is measured by God's standard, not ours. Go back to the end of verse 13. You'll see that Habakkuk is looking for a sliding scale here. He asked God, why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Now think about this. Again, Habakkuk, just a few verses earlier, Habakkuk is complaining about how unrighteous Judah is. He's complaining about how bad, how violent, how morally decayed his nation has come. But now the Babylonians are in the picture, and he's going, oh, wait a minute, they're worse. They're more wicked than we are. I mean, compared to them, we're righteous. That's what he's saying, right? And we all think like that. We all like to divide the world up into black hats and white hats. Right? The bad guys get black hats, the good guys get white hats, right? And in our minds, everybody's got either a black hat or a white hat. And you know who gets the white hat in this scenario? We do. Right? I mean, you're the one who's doing the judging, so you give yourself a white hat, right? So you get a white hat, and then you look around, and everybody who's worse than you are, everybody who's more bad than you, they get a black hat, right? That's how we do this. Maybe not black hats, but that's what we do in our minds. We're always keeping track of who's worse than we are. And the thing is, if we've assigned someone a black hat, and then we watch them, and we observe that life is going better for them than it is for us, then we start to wonder, how is that fair, right? We're better than they are, so how come things are going so great for them and they're going so bad for us? Well, here's the thing. When we're talking about the way God sees things, there's no sliding scale. It's not like God is going, well, you know, these people, well, these people, they're pretty good, but those people over there, they're not as good. But then that group of people, they're really pretty good, but these people, it's not like God is lining us all up and grading us on a bell curve. It doesn't work that way.
For God, there is no black hat, white hat. You know what God sees? God doesn't see black hats and white hats. You know what God sees when he looks at us? All black hats. Okay? I mean, when God looks at us, he's the one wearing the white hat because he's the only one who deserves to have a white hat. And he looks at us and all of us, we all have black hats compared to him because he's the standard. Not your neighbor, not the person next to you. God's the standard. He's the holy one. He's the one in the category by himself. So there's no sliding scale, and that leads to the second observation on fairness. Fairness is not always going to be in our favor. We have to understand this. If we want God to act with fairness, if we really want God to immediately judge every wrongdoing in the world, then you have to understand that's probably not going to go that well for you either. I mean, we can sympathize with Habakkuk. I mean, Habakkuk's situation is sort of like this. It's like if you live in a neighborhood, and it's not a very nice neighborhood, and there's a lot of drug dealing going on in your street, and there's a lot of violence and crime in your neighborhood, so you call the police up and you say to the police, hey, they're selling drugs down the street from me. Can you come in and do something about it? And the cops say, sure, we'll check it out. And they call you back a week later, and they say, you know what? Your neighborhood's terrible. So here's what we're going to do. Tuesday, we're going to bomb it. And you're kind of like, hey, wait a minute, I live in that neighborhood. Right? I mean, that's what happens for Habakkuk. Habakkuk says, God, how long is this going to go on? What are you going to do about it? God basically exercises the nuclear option. He sends in the Babylonians. So we can sympathize with Habakkuk. We can understand Habakkuk's frustration. But go back to the sliding scale. So often when we call on God to be fair, when we ask God for justice, what we mean is for God to bring justice to everybody else, but not us. It's like, hey, God, go out and judge them. You know, they're the ones wearing the black hats. But as far as I'm concerned, I'd really rather you weren't fair with me, but give me mercy. I need mercy. I want you to give justice. I want you to execute fairness with everybody else. But in my particular case, please, please have mercy. We forget that in God's eyes, we're all wearing black hats, and that if God were to judge everybody, we'd be in that group. So we need to keep in mind that as much as we want God to be fair, we're all desperately in need of his mercy as well. Now let's get back to the text. I mean, Habakkuk's still wondering, what about the Babylonians? Okay, if Judah deserves to be punished and they're bad, but still, the Babylonians are bad too, so what happens to them? So, chapter 2, verse 1. Habakkuk says, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Habakkuk pours out his heart to God and then he declares his intention to wait. And I'll suggest that Habakkuk's a very good model for us here. I appreciate Habakkuk's commitment to wait for God's answer. You know, last week I mentioned that there's a difference between questioning God and accusing God. Okay, questioning God is when you say, God, I know you're good. God, I know you have a plan, but I look at the earth and I don't understand what's going on, and so God, I'm wondering what's going on here. That's questioning God. Accusing God is when you say, look, God, you say you're good and you say you have a plan, but I look at the earth and I don't see it, and so God, I think you're a liar. Or God, I don't think you're doing your job very well. To accuse God is basically to say, you know, God, I think I could do your job better than you could. I think I would do a better job running this place than you do. That, I would suggest to you, is a bit of arrogance on our part. But what Habakkuk is doing, having questions and going to God and saying, God, I don't understand, please help me to understand, that's actually humility. That's faith. Habakkuk commits to wait for God's answer, and he knows, and this is the key, he knows that God has the answer. David Bass, president of Words of Hope, writes this. He says, Habakkuk believes both that there are answers, the right answers to his questions, and that God will reveal them. If our hope is that God will never give up on us, our faith means we never give up on God. And that's what Habakkuk is doing. He refuses to give up on God. He doesn't understand. It doesn't seem fair. But he refuses to give up on God. And finally, God does answer. Verses 2 through 5. Then the Lord replied, write down the revelation. Make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come. It will not delay. See, he's puffed up. His desires are not upright. But the righteous will live by his faith. Indeed, wine betrays him. He's arrogant, never at rest, because he's greedy as the grave. And like death is never satisfied, he gathers to himself all the nations, he takes captive all the peoples. If I may, I'm just going to read that section of Scripture again, but I'm going to put it in my own words now. Here's God's answer to Habakkuk. Basically, this is what God says. He says, Habakkuk, I'm going to give you a revelation. I'm going to give you a revelation. I want you to write it down. I'm going to give you a picture of what's coming. And while it might seem to you like it's a long time coming, don't give up, because it'll get there as soon as I mean for it to get there. And God says, remember, Habakkuk, the arrogant trust in themselves. The arrogant are always hungry for more. That's the Babylonians. But the righteous are the ones who trust in me. So keep trusting in me, Habakkuk, and you will see what I have planned. A lot of scholars think that this revelation that God is alluding to here is actually recorded for us in Habakkuk chapter 3. The first 15 verses of Habakkuk chapter 3 are what theologians call a theophany. It's a revelation of God. It's a picture of God in all of his majesty and glory. It's this awe-inspiring picture of God. And we'll look at that in the next couple of weeks, but I'll give you just a sample here. Habakkuk 3:3 says this, this picture of God, his glory covered the heavens, his praise filled the earth, his splendor was like the sunrise, rays flashed from his hand where his power was hidden. He stood and he shook the earth. He looked and he made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. Essentially, what God does is he comes to Habakkuk and he says, here, let me give you a glimpse of the future. Let me give you a glimpse of myself. You can trust in me. You can continue to put your faith in me, Habakkuk, because this is who I am. And also, as far as the Babylonians are concerned, he says their day is coming. Their time of judgment is coming. In fact, that's what we'll look at next week. The last section of chapter 2 is sort of a list of woes that are going to befall the Babylonians. God is essentially saying, look, I'm stronger than they are. They're fierce and they're mighty and they're problems, but I'm bigger than your problems. That's what we'll look at next week. But what I want to do now today with the rest of our time is just direct you back to Habakkuk 2, verse 4. Verse I looked at last week, I told you that this is the key verse in all of Habakkuk. This verse gets quoted numerous times in the New Testament. I think the Apostle Paul would tell you this is one of his favorite verses. Martin Luther starts the Reformation based partly on what this verse says. It's an important verse in the Bible. It's an important verse in Habakkuk. So I'd like to direct you back there again. What I'd like to do today, last week I took you to the book of Hebrews and showed you where this verse is quoted. This time I'd like to take you to the book of Romans. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. And here Paul quotes this verse from Habakkuk, and he bases a huge amount of his teaching, a huge amount of what we believe as Christians gets based on this verse. So here it is, Romans 1, 16 and 17. Paul writes, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written. And here's the quote from Habakkuk, the righteous will live by faith. And if you skip ahead a couple verses in, or a couple chapters in Romans, another verse, it's not a direct quote from Habakkuk, but still along those lines, Romans 3:22. Paul writes, this righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Basically, what Paul is saying here is that that line from Habakkuk 2, the righteous will live by faith, can kind of be understood in a couple of ways. On the one hand, he's saying the righteous person will live, will have life because of his faith. The proud are going to disappear, the arrogant won't endure, but the righteous who are living by faith, that is, those who go on trusting God even when they don't understand what God is doing, they will live forever. That's what this verse is saying. That's what Paul understands it to mean. The righteous will live by faith. But more than that, and on the other hand, those who live by faith are also righteous. It's the willingness to believe in God when there's little else to go by that makes us acceptable to God. It's that act of believing, that act of trusting that actually makes us right in God's eyes. Whether we understand what's happening or not, whether our circumstances are great or poor, when we choose to put our faith in God, He's pleased to count us as one of His. The righteous will live by faith. This is the core of the Christian gospel. This is how we're saved. This is what we mean when we use that phrase, justification by faith. This is what we mean. It's through our faith that we're made right with God. Now, of course, in this sense, the content of our faith is vital. It's not just believing that God exists. It's not just believing that God will make everything good in the end. It's believing something very specific about God, and that's what Romans 3:22 is getting at. It's faith in Jesus Christ. It's faith that in Jesus God has created a way for our black hats to be exchanged for white hats because of what Jesus has done by fairly dealing with the consequences and penalties of our wickedness. Because of what Jesus did in becoming an atoning sacrifice for our sin, He takes His white hat off, and Jesus, the only one who in all of creation, in all the history of the world, has ever deserved to have a white hat. Jesus goes to the cross and He takes His white hat off and He takes our black hats in exchange and He pays the penalty for our sin. Paul says elsewhere, he says that He who had no sin becomes sin for us so that in Him we might become the righteousness of God. That's the gospel. That's how we are made right in the eyes of God. And it's in believing that that we become righteous. It's in believing that that we are saved. That's what this verse, Habakkuk 2:4, is teaching. But incidentally, and now we get back to the topic of the day, I think that also points us to the most important answer concerning the question of whether or not God is fair. I'll make one more observation on fairness, and I'll phrase it like this. You need to know that God enters into our world of unfairness. Whenever you struggle with the issue of evil and suffering and God's fairness in this broken world, this one thing must be kept in mind. God sent His Son to suffer cruelly on our behalf. Jesus Christ, God's own Son, who is to be worshipped as God, who is rightfully called God, suffered an excruciating, odious, and shameful death. As D.A. Carson writes, the God on whom we rely knows what suffering is all about, not merely in the way that God knows everything, but by experience. This is so important when you begin to ask questions about whether or not God is fair in the midst of your suffering. It's for us to understand that our God Himself has suffered. Greg Boyd is a seminary professor, church pastor up in the Twin Cities, and some years ago, it's almost 20 years ago now, he wrote a book called Letters from a Skeptic. And what this book is, it's a really neat book. It's an exchange of letters between Greg and his father. And at the time, his father was not a Christian, did not believe in Jesus. Greg was. And what Greg did was he said, Dad, I really want you to understand what it is I believe. And so I'm going to invite you. His dad lived in Florida. He lived in the Twin Cities. This is prior to email. He said, I'm just going to invite you. Write me a letter. Ask me your questions. Ask me your best questions about Christianity. I will try to answer as best as I can. And so there's this series of letters. His dad would ask a question. Greg would try to answer. It would lead to new questions, and Greg would try to answer. And by the end, his dad does become a Christian. And so then they decided they'd take those letters and make a book out of them. And so many of the questions, one of the main questions that keeps coming up in this book is the question of suffering. And when Greg was a young boy, his mother, Arlyle, died of cancer. And she suffered terribly in the midst of her cancer before she passed away. And so Dad wonders, how can you believe in a good God? How could a good God allow that to happen to Arlyle? Allow her to suffer like that? Take her away from us when you were still so young? You know, what about that? What about suffering? Is God fair? And this is a part of Greg's answer. He says, Dad, you may remember that my first year in college, I went through a long period of acute doubt over the truth of Christianity. This problem we've been discussing, this problem of evil, was at the heart of it. I was torn between two opposing convictions. The world, with all of its beauty and design and intricacy and personal characteristics, demands that there must be a God.
But I thought at the time that the suffering of the world says that there can't be a God. It all came to a head for me one cold February night as I was walking back from an astronomy class at the University of Minnesota. Thinking of the grandeur of the stars we'd just been looking at, I was saying to myself, there must be a God. But thinking of the nightmarish suffering of Auschwitz, I was saying to myself, there can't be a God. These two thoughts were battling with each other at hyperspeed. I was tormented. And finally, just as I approached my car, I looked up at the sky and I cried out with a loud, angry voice, the only God I can believe in is one who knows firsthand what it's like to be a Jewish child being born alive, being buried alive. He said, the only God I can believe in is a God who knows what it's like to be a Jewish mother watching her child being ripped from her arms. And he writes, and then just then it occurred to me, or was it revealed, that is exactly the kind of God Christianity proclaims. There's no other belief which does this. Only the gospel dares to proclaim that God enters smack dab into the middle of the hell we create. Only the gospel dares to proclaim that God was born a baby in a bloody, smelly stable, that He lived a life befriending the prostitutes and lepers no one else would befriend, that He suffered firsthand the hellish depth of all that's nightmarish in human existence. Only the gospel portrait of God makes sense of the contradictory fact that the world is at once so beautiful and so ugly. I guess what I'm saying, Dad, is this. I don't know exactly why God didn't answer our prayers for Arlisle. I know that if it wasn't for human sin, if we weren't involved in this spiritual war, this painful situation would never have happened. But more important than this explanation is this. God was suffering with you and me in Arlisle throughout the whole affair. He cries too. And through His participation in our pain, He wants to redeem it. And for me, I think this point is so important. And we can talk about the black hats and how all we really deserve from God is judgment anyway. But if God's just some distant deity who's sitting impassively up on a throne in heaven sort of watching as our lives unfold, that's still pretty hard to take. There are just too many times when life doesn't make sense, too many events that seem too unfair. But knowing that God got off His throne and entered into the very midst of all this unfairness, that He suffered more unfairly, more unjustly than you and I ever will, helps me have faith that God does understand. He's been here, He's suffered, and He has a plan for our pain. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, a book like Habakkuk, the questions that it raises, Lord, we know that they are hard questions, and often there are more questions than there are answers. But the answer that does keep coming back, Lord, is that we just need to trust in You, that we just need to have faith in You, that we need to trust that You know what You're doing. And when that gets hard and when it seems unfair and the questions loom large, Lord, it helps for us to know that You've been here, that You've suffered, that You've felt pain. And so, Lord, help us to look to Jesus on the cross and remember that He understands our pain, He understands our suffering. And let that picture help us to trust You more. It is in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen.